Our guest this morning, we're very privileged to have Yves Engler. He's the author of The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy. Welcome to our show, Yves.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Now, your book, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, has been described as the sequel to your previous book, Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. Our image of Canadian foreign policy, and most Canadians, I would argue, see the Canadian identity as one of peacekeeping and peacemaker around the world. How did we come up with this view, and what evidence do you have to challenge this?
Well, I think that the idea that Canadians or Canada is a benevolent force in the world is very deep-rooted. Studies suggest as many as 9 in 10 Canadians believe that Canada is a force for good in the world, and actually Canadians have the highest self-appraisal of their country's role in the world compared to any other country. So it is pretty deep-rooted. I think that there's some reasons to hold it that are sort of somewhat legitimate on one level. I mean, the fact that Canada never formally had colonies, unlike most of Western Europe, Japan, and the U.S. to some extent. Now, that, of course, is denying the internal history of colonization of indigenous people that we should not, of course, deny. But I think that in the current phase of this sort of mythology, it really centers around peacekeeping and sort of Lester Pearson's role in establishing the peacekeeping mission that intervened in Egypt in 1956 during the Suez Crisis. And I think that Canadian politicians, the foreign policy establishment, have really consciously taken on the elements of empire, which I think peacekeeping really was in the context of the Cold War. Peacekeeping was about advancing U.S. geopolitical interests. And I think taking on the sort of high-minded elements of U.S. empire and really consciously sort of choosing this the most benevolent forms and being kind of a good cop to the U.S. bad cop, which I think that that's you know, sort of that Canada's niche within U.S. imperial policy, and that of course has sort of trickled down to many Canadians to thinking that this country sort of acts benevolently around the world.
What led you to write the book, The Black Book on Canadian Foreign Policy? What kinds of things is our government hiding from us that you would like people to know?
For me, writing the book really came out of participating in the Haiti Solidarity Movement and learning about what Canada had done in Haiti and being really taken aback. I guess I was a little bit naive about Canada's role in the world before participating in the Haiti Solidarity Movement. I had an understanding of the class dynamics of Canadian society, and I had a little bit of understanding of the history of dispossession of indigenous people in this country, but I didn't think that Ottawa acts like Washington does on the international sphere. And the case of Haiti, the coup d'etat, February 2004, and Canada's support for the coup, and then real strong at every level, diplomatic, financial, military support for this brutal dictatorship that was really imposed on Haiti after the coup from Washington, the U.S., and from Washington, Canada, and France. And seeing this, the extent to which Canada participated in this crime against Haitian people really took me aback. So I basically decided, after the worst of the repression subsided in Haiti, I decided to take a look at Canada's role around the world and to see if Canada had acted similarly elsewhere. And what I found was that, yeah, in fact, there's a long history of Canada supporting, on one hand, supporting U.S. imperial maneuvers such as overthrowing Salvador Allende, significant Canadian support, destabilization of Salvador Allende and support for the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile, very significant quiet support for the U.S. war in Vietnam, Canada's role in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, quite significant, a whole history of Canadian gunboat diplomacy, particularly in the Caribbean and Central America, where Canadian gunboats would be sent off the coast of Costa Rica to help the Royal Bank negotiate an outstanding debt with the Costa Rican government, Canadian gunboats being sent to El Salvador to support putting down a peasant uprising in 1932, really, and then the whole other element that often, I think too often, goes not discussed, particularly among the left nationalists in this country, is the role of Canadian corporations around the world, particularly in recent years in the mining sector, just story after story of Canadian corporations, Canadian mining companies, supported by our diplomacy, supported by our aid dollars, really just destroying communities, causing incredible amounts of social tension, hiring paramilitaries, et cetera, et cetera. When at looking at all the different elements of Canada's role in the world, and I think what we've been told is far from the reality of this country's role in the world.
One of the things that I think seems evident at first is that when you describe the issue of class warfare and how many of these invasions perhaps have been to maintain the control by a very small elite or, you know, interest elites in countries like the Pinochet dictatorship, for instance. Right now the coup in Honduras is a salient example of how Canada has seemed to play a role in upholding despots, basically. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how does this happen? Because we are told by our media and by our education system that policies of this nature need to be left to the experts. Who are the architects, then, of our foreign policy? In whose interests are these policies being designed?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly it, is that we need to democratize Canadian foreign policy. The problem is that it's a little foreign policy establishment that has overwhelming influence, control over Canadian policy around the world. And that foreign policy establishment, which is sort of, broadly speaking, made up of the military generals, the armament companies, the banking companies operating around the world, the Canadian mining companies, a handful of politicians, they have very clear interests, often centering around their own personal profit or sort of Canada's role within the larger U.S. imperial program. The will or the interests of the vast majority of Canadians is kind of left out of the picture. And they're able to do that even more so, of course, when it comes to domestic policy. It's, of course, designed largely in the interests of the elite as well. But in the case of foreign policy, it's that much worse, because in the case of foreign policy, the influence that this foreign policy establishment has is much greater than domestic policy. That's because the majority of Canadians aren't paying very close attention, don't have a personal sort of tie to the issue. So the media can tell us that Canada is just trying to help the poor of Haiti. Most Canadians haven't been to Haiti, so they can't really judge those lies against, you know, sort of the reality of what's actually taking place. So I think that, like, you know, when it comes to lies about domestic policies, can tell us that, you know, this union is on strike and it's just trying to take, trying to get all it can, and or you can tell us that the healthcare system is about to be destroyed, whatever. We actually have personal experience with those things, and we can sort of judge what the media is saying versus our personal experience, and oftentimes our personal experience is obviously much more powerful than what the media is saying to ourselves. And so we have a better way of judging what's being said about domestic policy. When it comes to foreign policy, the ability for the media and the politicians to lie is that much greater. And so I think that really kind of what at the heart of the issue is the fact that there's this foreign policy establishment that has very specific interests, and it works to orient Canadian foreign policy to improve its interests, to better its interests, and the vast majority of Canadians are left out of the picture, are not engaged on learning about what Canada is doing in the world, are not engaged in trying to influence what Canada is doing in the world, and so that leaves the space open for this sort of foreign policy establishment to really use the Canadian state to their advantage. And also, and then it comes into the questions of nationalism, and people have grown up with this sort of mythology of Canada as a force for good. And so just the assumption, the de facto assumption is that, you know, of course maybe there was a mistake at worst, but, you know, they're trying, the Canadian military is trying to improve Afghan women's situation, is trying to improve the situation of poor Afghans. The assumption should in reality be, how is the Canadian military and armament companies and politicians trying to, you know, sort of advance their interests? That's what we should assume when we look at any foreign policy issue. Instead, we assume, because we've been sort of grown up with all this mythology, oh, you know, yeah, Canada's trying to help out, and maybe there was a mistake, but, you know, the intentions are good.
Many people in Latin America challenge this idea that the countries of the north, of the superpowers, those with the military, might have basically assigned themselves the role of benevolence, of being the guardian of the world and, you know, bringing peace. But very few people in the Western world challenge sometimes the imposed now increasing surveillance on their cities and this erosion of human rights that we're seeing even taking place in our own backyard. Why do you think we undermine our own rights sometimes and buy into this idea of policing the world, keep us safe? How do we challenge that? How do we break out of that?
I think the best way to break out of it is with a bit of history. Anyone who understands a little bit what Canadian government did in Haiti, and that doesn't come at it from with a real intent of you know, proving how benevolent this country is, but actually sort of looks at what the poor of Haiti are saying and what the consequence of Canada's intervention was and is, they will understand quite quickly that the politicians lie to us. The aim of this book is to really build some of that critical consciousness about Canadian foreign policy. And the way to do that is to say, hey, look at this. This is a history of Canada supporting the overthrow of elected governments, social democratic or socialist oriented elected governments in Latin America, for instance. And so when we come to the recent coup in Honduras, our assumption is not, Canada is, of course, siding with democracy. Our assumption should be, how is Canada supporting the small elite of Honduras, and how is Canada working to undermine the social transformation taking place in Honduras? So I think it really comes down to having a little bit of historical context of the reality of what this country has done, and then that will better inform what it's likely to be doing today and likely to be doing in the future, unless we actually build this movement of critical consciousness that can actually challenge Canadian foreign policy in a serious way.
In a previous interview with Dr. Alan Seeger, he's a historian as well, and he pointed out that in the present state of the world of economics, it seems that economic power has more bearing than military might, in essence. And so, in your opinion, what are some of the economic issues that are impacting our foreign policy? And for that matter, who are those whose interests are being addressed through our economic policies?
If you take a look at Latin America particularly, Canadian foreign policy is mostly centered around Canadian foreign investment. There's more than $100 billion annually of Canadian foreign investment throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. I think it's as much as $40 billion of that is in the mining sector. And there is pretty much any country in this hemisphere, including the U.S., and of course including Canada, there is one or more stories of a Canadian mining company just doing some sort of terribly destructive ecological, socially mining venture. And in that way, I think that you know, the face of Canadian foreign policy, and that's almost entirely being supported by, in different ways, through rewriting, like in the instance of Colombia, Canada helped rewrite Colombia's mining code to make the mining sector more open to foreign investment, to improve the profits of foreign companies. The Canadian diplomats in Ecuador working to put pressure on the Correa government to improve the situation for foreign mining companies, to really just sort of in a whole series of different ways in which Canadian diplomacy supports this investment. So I think that, like in the case of Canada's role in Latin America, you really see the main face of that policy is corporate. It's Canadian banks who have major investors in Mexico, in Peru, and throughout the English Caribbean, completely dominate the English Caribbean banking sector. And so you really have, I think, the main face of Canadian foreign policy in this hemisphere, at least, slightly different in other parts of the world, is really corporate interests. And what's behind those corporate interests, the people of Peter Munk from Barrick Gold, who is basically a sort of open fascist, who is a strong supporter of Pinochet, going years after Pinochet was even taken out of power, to seriously antagonistic to the Chavez government, saying some very outlandish comments about Hugo Chavez, and so really the face of the Canadian capitalist class that's heavily invested in Latin America, is a face of a very obviously self-interested, anti-democratic group of people who are basically looking to make more money, and they are well connected with politicians, foreign affairs department, and they really, you know, work to have the politicians and bureaucrats advance their interests. And the consequences for people in Ecuador who have these Canadian mining companies come in and destroy their community, the consequences for indigenous communities in Guatemala are really severe. They're not just sort of, you know, the effect is really severe, and this goes almost entirely unreported in the Canadian media, almost entirely just unreported. The corporate media in this country, for some reason, it's not relevant. You know, front page of La Jornada, the Mexican daily, about a week ago, was all about how Canadian mining companies, huge front page headline, all about how Canadian mining companies own more than 70% of mining concessions in Mexico. And that, that's just not reported in Canada about the role, and then a whole big 1,500 word article all about these horror story after horror story in Mexico of Canadian mining companies. That just goes completely unreported in Canadian media.
It's almost overwhelming to learn firsthand about the kind of genocide that goes on. This morning we had an interview with Justin Pudor speaking about the Congo and how the genocide is being facilitated through military from Rwanda, but it actually has been aided. There's been financial aid coming from the Western countries to continue the exploration of resources in that region and exacerbating the suffering of people. How do you hope your book will impact people and move people into action? What responsibility do we have, and how do you hope to mobilize people to take action? What things can they do?
I think the first thing is to get informed and to break this mythology down, that just where the assumption is just that Canada does positive. The second thing is to start building networks, and they exist already. There's numerous solidarity groups already exist on a whole slew of issues, from the Canada Haiti Action Network, which is an ongoing network of Haiti solidarity groups, to things like the Canadian Peace Alliance, to some of the Latin American solidarity groups. The problem with almost all of these groups is that they're too small. It's not that they're not doing really good work or really important work. It's that they're too small, and we need more people to participate, to help out, to fund the groups, to come to the demonstrations, come to the meetings, whatever. And it's just a matter of it's not a matter of reinventing the wheel. It's a matter of really sort of strengthening the groups that already exist. But then additionally, I think it's a matter of different groups sort of coming together and seeing that I'm not just working on Palestinian solidarity and that somehow we're going to have a just peace for Palestinians without having, or you know, more particularly having Canada support something close to justice for Palestinians, without having also Canada's, you know, pulling its troops out of Afghanistan, and you know, Canadian foreign policy in towards the coup in Honduras be changed. To me, working on specific issues, because when it comes down to it, we only have so much time in the day, and you know, you sort of get into one issue, and you know, the issue that I've really focused on for the last few years is Canada's role in Haiti. But it's a matter of seeing those issues tied together and doing what we can to support people working on those other issues, and you know, that whole circle of solidarity coming back around. And to me, it's really a matter of building a movement in this country that is critical of Canadian foreign policy, sees Canadian foreign policy as being motivated above all else by particular corporate interests on one hand, and being motivated by U.S. Imperial aims. I really think the thrust of Canadian foreign policy going back to this pre-support of U.S. empire, going back to support for the British Empire, really is two motivations of Canadian foreign policy: supporting empire, be it historically British, today American, and supporting Canadian corporate interests abroad. Certainly racism does affect Canadian foreign policy at times, but above all else, it's really it's about support for empire and support for corporate interests. And seeing when we're doing particular work, when we're doing, you know, Palestinian solidarity work, or we're opposing Canada's role in the coup in Honduras, it's to, you know, do work on the specific, but also not undermine the other issues. So, for instance, when people write articles or statements that say that Canada should stop supporting the coup in Honduras because it's got to return to its good history of supporting democracy, that undermines future movements that challenge Canadian foreign policy, because the reality is that Canada has almost always sided with elite interests in Latin America. And if we say statements like, or in the case of pro-Palestinian work, you know, Canada has to return to the good old days when it was an honest broker on the Palestinian issue. That honest broker day never exists. There is no history of Canada as being an honest broker. There's a history of being more, you know, the Harper government's more pro-Israel than the Paul Martin government. The Paul Martin government was more pro-Israel than the Chrétien government. But there's never a history where Canada was actually siding with the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinian people. And when we make statements that contradict the history and that reinforce this mythology, I think that we're ultimately are setting our movement back. So I think it's really a matter of taking on specific issues, but also doing it within the context of seeing that we're going to build a broader anti-imperialist movement that sees the world as, you know, that sees all people as having equal rights around the world. And just because I happen to be born in Canada doesn't mean that I have special rights over somebody who happens to be born in a slum in Haiti.
Thank you so much for being with us, Yves. Can you give us your website for people who want more information, people who want to access your book, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policies?
Yeah, it's blackbook.foreignpolicy.ca, so blackbook.foreignpolicy.ca, and you can order the book there. There's some reviews of the book, and there's my contact information, all that kind of stuff.
Thank you again for being with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Take care. Bye.